Bernard Schlink's novel The Reader made a huge impression on readers all over the world. That was about the 15-year-old boy's affair with an older woman. She was in her 30s, a woman who later turned out to have been a concentration camp guard and was brought to trial for war crimes, by which time the boy is a young law student observing the court and asking himself how this woman he loved could be the same person on trial. It's now a film starring Kate Winslet and Ralph Fiennes. And Bernard Schlink's published another novel, Homecoming, since. That was the story of a half-Swiss-German, half-German boy without a father who spends his holidays with his Swiss grandparents. The boy is obsessed with a story about a young German soldier who escapes from a Russian prison camp and embarks, like Ulysses, on a fabulous journey home to his wife. And Bernard's also written short stories as well as a series of crime novels. He remains a professor of public law and legal philosophy, and for many years he was also a judge at a German constitutional law court. He's in Australia to talk about a book of essays called Guilt About the Past. They're based on the Weidenfeld lectures he delivered at Oxford University in 2008. And Bernard Schlink joins me now. Welcome to the book show, Bernard, and good to see you again.
It's good to see you again.
We've met in countries all over the world.
Yes, we did.
In your very first page in this book, Guilt About the Past, these essays, you talk about guilt as an infection, infected with the guilt of previous generations. You say when we speak of guilt about the past, we're not thinking about individuals or even organisations, but rather a guilt that infects the entire generation that lives through an era, and in a sense the era itself. Is guilt an illness?
No, maybe entanglement would be a better word than infection. What I was trying to talk about is that those who are not perpetrators themselves, nor their supporters, nor bystanders, can also become guilty.
So let's talk about your own story first, because you say that your formative years had this centrality of the Third Reich and the Holocaust. You were born in 1944, so you didn't exist when all of these things happened. Tell me about your early years. What sort of a family did you grow up in?
My father was a theologian who had been a professor until the Nazis forced him out of university. Then he was a pastor to become a professor again after the end of the war. So I grew up in what is something proverbial in German, das protestantische Pfarrhaus, the Protestant pastor's home, with all its rituals and house music and love of culture. So what for many of my generation was an experience with the own parents, for me was rather experience with distant relatives, with teachers, with professors, that at one point I found out that the beloved teacher, whom I admired and to whom I owed a lot, turned out to have been involved in something awful from the Third Reich. Or the professor. I finally found out what he had written in the Third Reich. So this experience of growing up and at one point being confronted with those whom we love, admire, having been having played a role in the Third Reich is what, in a way, this notion of infection and entanglement is about.
So your father then lost his job at the university during the war. What happened to him then and your mother?
Well, he became a pastor. He just couldn't be at the university anymore. And in the Third Reich, the German Protestant Church was also divided between the confessing church and the German Christians. The German Christians were the Nazi Christians, and the confessing church was the other side. And there were churches where members of the confessing church invited their pastors to teach, to preach with some distance, a little distance that was possible to the Third Reich.
So when you were growing up, when you were at school, when you were young, what did your parents say about the war? I mean, you must have been able to see, did you see around they you growing up in your town that there was evidence that there had been a war?
Well, not in Heidelberg, where I grew up. Obviously, the Americans had earlier decided to make Heidelberg into their headquarters, so Heidelberg wasn't bombed. But when I visited my grandparents in the neighboring Darmstadt, or when I went to Mannheim, another neighboring town, yes, I remember very well that big parts of the city were flat and only were built up over the years of my childhood.
And what did you know about that? How did you think it got like that?
Well, of course, we knew about the war. But
did you know you'd lost the war?
Absolutely. Absolutely did I know that we lost the war. I mean, the strong American presence in Heidelberg, the uniforms, sometimes they were nice and sweet and sometimes they were a little bit nasty. No, of course we knew that we had lost the war. Our parents didn't talk a lot about it. And for quite some time in the 60s, I thought, oh, our parent generation kind of silences the past on purpose. Now, after I have seen the wall come down and I have seen the East Germans equally unwilling to talk about the past, I have come to realize that after the life has changed so profoundly, like during a war and a defeat or during a system change as in East Germany, all energy goes to the future. For 5, 10, 15 years, all energy goes to the future. And in East Germany now, gradually, and it's to a certain extent the next generation, gets interested in what has happened. The old generation just wants to go on with its life.
So if we back to the late 40s and the 50s then in Germany, the idea then to get a government going again, to get institutions happening, to get the education system going.
To get the economy going. That was such a primary concern that to think about the past just didn't seem that important.
So who?
Of course, we had trials after 45. We had the Nuremberg trials. And for a number of years, we had German trials too. And then, yeah, the Nuremberg trials were over. The Allied forces were more interested in preparing for the Cold War and integrating Germany into the Western alliance. And the Germans weren't so interested in having these trials anyway. So the 50s were not years with a strong attention for the past.
So presumably one had to get people who knew what they were doing into those positions. So who knew what they were doing presumably were people who had those positions in the Third Reich.
Sometimes the same or sometimes similar positions. With some, it took a while. So in academia, there were professors who were only allowed back into the system in the early 50s after a period of time doing whatever. But yes, in the mid-50s, I think one can say that most who had held a position of importance in the Third Reich had found another acceptable or even important position in the young Federal Republic.
So in the 60s, as you say, you're now in your 20s.
Yeah.
At university, and the Auschwitz trials begin. And what years were that? Was that early 60s to the late 60s, wasn't it?
That was 63, 4, 5. That was had a very strong impact on all of us.
How come it took 20 years for those trials to happen? What was going on? Who was engineering the trials?
It's interesting. It could have even taken longer. In the late 50s, we had the first trial of this new series of trials. And it only came to the trial because one member of the Einsatzgruppen, you know, these groups that behind the front killed Jews, but also Poles and Russians. He insisted on getting a better pension than he got, to the point that it became so public what he had done that the prosecutor's office decided something had to happen. And then a special prosecutor's office was instituted that focused only on the crimes of the Third Reich.
So if that man hadn't been so insistent on his pension, nothing would have happened.
Well, it could have taken another couple of years. But it shows, his mentality shows the atmosphere of those years.
And he felt he could.
Could, yeah. But, okay, then the judicial system responded, instituting this special prosecutor's office. And they did a great job. I mean, those who went there were those who really wanted to change things. And that led to the Auschwitz trials.
So you're a young law student, and yeah. Suddenly, does this come out of nowhere? Suddenly, these Auschwitz trials?
Much changed, yes.
For your consciousness.
For us, and I really can think, I can talk for my generation, it came out of nowhere. I mean, we hadn't been aware of the Ulmer Einsatzgruppen process. We hadn't been aware of this new office. And suddenly we saw the results. But many other things happened in the mid-60s too. I mean, I remember when I started going to law school in 1963, we still had in our library what was called the poison closet. So the literature from the 30s, some of them, these books written by our own professors, were locked away. And only if you had a very special scholarly agenda, you might be allowed to look at these
books. Did you know what was in there?
Well, we learned about it gradually because there were rumors. And in the mid-60s, they couldn't keep this up anymore. So they had to open this poison closet. The past suddenly became a presence.
So you were able then to see that the people who were teaching you had written very anti-Semitic tracts in the time leading up to the Third Reich.
So not leading up to. There's a generation of young academics who often didn't find a position in the Weimar Republic in academia because there just weren't enough positions. And suddenly in 1933, all the Jewish professors were thrown out. So there was a rush of young German professors. And then in the years 33, 34, 35, they wrote these ideological tracts. Quite a number of them realized after the first enthusiastic years that it might be wiser not to go on writing this.
So there you have the Auschwitz trials starting. Did you attend those?
No, I didn't attend the Auschwitz trial. That was in Frankfurt. I attended a smaller trial in Mannheim, the neighboring town of Heidelberg.
So did this sort of blow your mind? How did you manage? Did you have competing feelings about learning this stuff suddenly? About who you were and what society you were living in?
Several things came together. One thing was on this rather personal level to realize that this one teacher in gymnasium whom I really liked a lot, or this professor at university whom I also liked a lot, and I owe both, one, my love for the English language, and the other, I think, that I became a professor for public law. So this was a somewhat personal level. Then there was all this information. And I think what was really devastating to realize that Germany, that seemed to be on such solid ground culturally, politically, up until the Weimar Republic, could change in such a short time so dramatically and could lose its good traditions, its sense of decency, its sense of political morality, and turn into what it was in the Third Reich. And I must say this stays something that I'm still struggling with.
I'm speaking with Bernard Schlink here on The Book Show on ABC Radio National, Ramona Koval here, and we're speaking about his newest book, Guilt About the Past, on ABC Radio National. Did I tell you that? I think I did. So, you know, you describe this meeting of Germans who go out into the world, outside Germany, children of perpetrators and victims, grandchildren of perpetrators and victims, having something to talk about and something to work out. You know, you and I sitting here, my parents were Holocaust survivors from Poland. And so, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, to meet each other?
Mm-hmm.
And what do we think? We think, where were your parents when this was happening? Where were my parents?
Yeah.
What roles were they playing? What is that connection that we have? How do you describe it?
Oh, I think it is our parent generation was in this awful thing, and so we are kids of our parents, and their identity becomes part of our identity. So meeting each other, we wonder, who are you? And so who are you is, what's your identity? And so they were there.
And what do you really think about me? We think that too, don't we?
Well, I never asked you as much about your past as you asked me about mine. And I think we Germans are always, maybe that's a mistake, maybe it's a Parsifal mistake, I don't know. We are always reluctant to ask as directly as you ask, because we wonder, oh, if there's a wound that we rather shouldn't touch. So we tend to wait until you or those of your generation start talking.
What about other friends of yours that you grew up with whose parents were more directly involved? I mean, you have a good story to tell about your parents, but what about those who've got a bad story to tell? How did you talk to them about what happened? Did you talk to them, to each other, of Germans of your generation?
Oh, sure, we talked about it, or we keep talking about it. And one of my fellow students was the nephew of Speer,
Albert Speer.
Albert Speer. Yeah. And it was something he didn't find it easy to cope with. And it was Heidelberg. And Speer was from Heidelberg. And he lived in Heidelberg. And I very well remember Speer coming out of prison. And I was at one concert, and from the balcony I looked down, and there he stood with his wife. And around him, it was a big crowd, around him there was a circle of emptiness. So people were reluctant to, even though he was from their town, to approach him.
So guilt could be an illness then, because didn't want to be associated. Yeah.
And so this is something that his nephew really had to struggle with. Or I know fellow students from high school whose fathers were SS officers, and they struggled with it. So can I love my father, and can I really insist on my father telling me what he did? And then realizing the father was reluctant to talk. So what do I have to figure out myself, and what can I insist on? No, it's has been a constant topic.
You talk also about the idea of forgiveness, about reconciliation. And you make the point that that Germany really had to have done something more than it did in those times after the war to really turn its own gaze on itself But on the other hand, you're saying that it's perfectly normal for people to just think about the future when something like a war has happened. So how do you reconcile that?
I can't reconcile that. I think more should have happened. And we talked about how the Auschwitz trial came to happen and this kind of accident with this guy who insists on getting his pension. That should have been dealt with differently, no doubt. At the same time, I can understand why they didn't rush to act differently. No, it can't be reconciled.
At one point, you say that putting oneself in the perpetrator's place can lead to forgiving. Are you talking about, say, the children of perpetrators putting themselves in the perpetrator's
place? No, I don't think that I said it leads to forgiving. I think more that we don't convict anyone these days anymore unless we have an understanding. We don't just take the action, but we want to know why the person did it and what was the background and how did he grow up or she. So I think we don't want to convict without some understanding. I think reconciliation isn't possible without understanding. And this understanding then can lead to or can make forgiving easier, but not necessarily. I think a good reason to forgive is to make your own peace with what happened. And you don't really mean so much the perpetrator whom you forgive, but you rather mean, okay, I want to make my peace and move on with my life. It's a complex issue, but no, understanding doesn't automatically lead to forgiving.
So you also talk in the book about the idea of teaching moral courage, trying to find more people like your father would have been in a society. And part of that, I suppose, is strengthening institutions. But how do we teach moral courage? I mean, What are the
Well, I think
approaches?
Even in the case of my father, it was not as much an issue of individual moral courage, but he felt himself being part of something bigger. And if you look at those who actually resisted to a bigger or smaller degree in the Third Reich, they felt being the part of the church, the Communist Party and the proletarian movement, nobility and the tradition, the good tradition of Prussian officerhood. So I think it was one of the mistakes of my generation, the attempt to teach in schools kids moral courage so that they would be better than their
grandparents. And how was that taught? What are the exercises that you did for moral courage?
The teachers of my generation in gymnasium or other schools, they talked about individual examples. So this person, he or she could resist. And so why could he or she resist? Maybe because early on the person understood where it was going, so it resisted early before it was too late. So it focused on individual stories. And I think it should have focused much more on institutions. What can we do to keep our institutions intact, to make them immune against what happened in 33 or more immune?
I mean, and this has been your life's interest, your legal interest in institutions.
That's right, yeah.
And what is the answer to that? I mean, is it about constitutions of institutions being perfectly written so that nothing can go wrong? Is it about people you appoint and processes? It's about attention to detail. What is it?
Oh, there's no recipe that grants that institutions won't tumble and fall. I think it is important that institutions are understood not as something out there. And me and my feelings and my morality is somewhere else. But it's important that people can feel engaged in institutions with their morality, with their creativity, with everything they have. And I think that's the only way to strengthen institutions against something like 1933.
And I'm speaking with Bernard Schlink here on The Book Show on ABC Radio National. And Bernard, you tell a story, seemingly a completely different story, about someone called Volcker N and Professor S. And this question about the acceptance of Volcker into the Association of German Constitutional Law Professors.
Yeah.
It's a little story. It's a little a story that tells a big story. Mm. But can you tell us that story?
Well, this friend and later colleague of mine, Volcker N., he, in the days of student unrest, was one of the radicals. And without actually having attacked this other Professor S., he certainly was a thorn in the eyes of Professor S. and those like him. So then decades later, Volcker N. applies for admittance to this association. And without being in this association, you can't get anywhere in German constitutional law. And then Professor S. mobilizes his friends so that he shouldn't be allowed in. And we got him in. I was one of those who spoke for him. It looked like the majority wouldn't accept him because they clapped loudly when the others talked and not when we spoke. But he was allowed in. What made this little story so crucial for myself was that trying to get him in, I didn't confront the others. I didn't say, hey, come on, this was this incident, and the student protest was triggered by you, Professor S, slapping a student, a girl. So stop this. You have no right to do it. But we maneuvered diplomatically to not make this conflict so big that then Volcker N would be its victim. And I kept wondering, did I do the right thing? I was successful. But
for the wrong reasons, maybe.
I gave away so much in my diplomatic maneuvering. And it happened that at the same time I read the dissertation of a student of mine, assistant of mine, actually, who talks about the first months after the Machtergreifung in 1933 and the Jewish professors at Humboldt University. And the Jewish professors and their colleagues, I mean, they were all bourgeois characters, not too politicized. They decided, okay, the Jewish dean should step down and the Jewish vice dean should step down too. We don't want any conflict. We maneuver diplomatically and at one point this whole thing will be over. And when it turned out that the diplomatic maneuvers didn't work, it was too late to protest, because diplomatic maneuver entangles you into this big maneuver that's taking place. So this little story made me aware of something, or reminded me of something bigger, and the difficulties to make the right choice.
In the last chapter of this book of essays, you write about writing about history, and you write about whether there are any rules for fiction dealing with the past, and And your experience has been, like, you know, with your writing The Reader, lots of people have said that, you know, you've got this one concentration camp guard. She finds herself taken up into this position. She doesn't necessarily want to be a concentration camp guard, and she's not a cruel person in her everyday life that this young man has discovered.
But she has a cruel streak even in her. In their love affair.
She has. Yeah. But it flowers in the concentration camp. And people have said, well, why have you created this character? Are you saying that all concentration camp guards were like this and they had a reason to be like they were because this one couldn't read, so all the others have some kind of excuse? I mean, there have been critiques that I've read. So. And you come to really answer this. What is your answer about how to write about the past? I mean, it is. Novelists can't go around with chains on their hands and saying you can only write about this kind of character in that kind of situation. I mean,
I think a mistake is to demand that characters in fiction or stories in fiction are statistically representative. I think that's not a demand that makes sense. I think it makes sense to say it should be a plausible character and should be a plausible story, even not statistically prevalent. And even that, you can work with satire or caricature or the absurd, and everybody knows this is an absurd character, but still it tells something about the past. In the case of Hannah Schmitz, the character of The Reader, I think what is true, not so much about the past. And my book is not a Holocaust novel. It's a novel about the second generation dealing with the first generation that was involved in the Holocaust. This experience that someone is nice and lovable and admirable and then turns out to have done something awful. That's, I would say, even a statistically interesting experience.
So did you feel attacked when people came and had this critique of you? Were you mystified by it?
Oh, it's interesting. It was so interesting from whom what critique came. So I remember in New York, I was invited several times by elderly Jewish people who had read the book, who even had, many of them had emigrated, had fled, had to leave, have been thrown out. And they were very interested in these ambiguities, ambivalences of the second generation experience. In Israel, I remember several people of my generation or even younger saying, there must be no dilemma between understanding and condemning. You just have to condemn. Loving someone, admiring someone who has done something awful is unforgivable even if you are a child. So I think the older people have more of a sense of complexity. And the critique often came from younger people. Or sometimes I really think from people who misunderstand literature and think it has to be statistically representative.
So, I mean, I've read your short stories and your novel Homecoming, and obviously all of your legal work has been focused on these ideas. I mean, your whole life has really been as a result of this period in history. Would that be fair to say?
A big part of my life. The last novel that has been published in German and will come out in English, I think, next year is The Weekend. It's a story about a terrorist from this Baader-Meinhof group being pardoned after 20 and something years in prison. And his sister thinks it's a good idea not to bring him right back into the life in the city, but go for a weekend with him and invite all the old friends. So it's a weekend where all these friends meet and talk about what had happened in the 70s and 80s. And right now I'm writing short stories, and some are, as among the old short stories, some are completely unrelated. Yes, but it is.
Is that a relief?
I must say, for me, writing is always fun, even if it's a difficult topic. I just enjoy writing so much.
Well, the book we've been speaking about is called Guilt About the Past. It's published in Australia by the University of Queensland Press. And, as well as being a writer, Bernard Schlink is also has been a judge. And while he's here in Australia, he'll be taking part in a conversation with former High Court Judge Michael Kirby and others, in which they'll think about the question, should judges just apply the law or should they bring their own values to the task? And the Law Report's Damien Carrick is moderating that discussion, and they'll be broadcasting it in the coming weeks on the Law Report. And if you're in Sydney next Monday, you can hear Bernard Schlink speak at the City Recital Hall at 6:30 p.m. He'll be talking about whether fiction can be used to deal with emotive historical subjects. And we'll put details of that on our website at abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. It's been good to speak with you again, Bernard.
It was good to speak to you again. Thank you.